Today, it's my pleasure to be speaking with McLean County State's Attorney, Erica Reynolds. We'll be covering some of the biggest and most important legislative changes affecting our area today and what exactly they entail. Not to jinx us, but I think this is going to be a very interesting and educational conversation. But without further ado, Erica, thank you so much for coming on today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the invite, and I'm excited to get started.
Of course, and the pleasure is all mine. So from articles that I just saw in looking you up and stuff and preparing for this interview, I saw that you were part of what seemed like some big-time cases involving children, like in the recent past. Could you tell us anything about those? Are you even allowed to talk about those cases, or what can you tell me?
I can't tell you a lot of specifics, but I can tell you generally how they happened. So in 2018, the Crimes Against Children prosecutor left our office to essentially be closer to family. And so I had the opportunity to apply for that position. And then state's attorney, now Judge Don Knapp, gave me that position. And so for 4 years, I prosecuted, I prosecuted those cases. So essentially, those cases come to you or come to my desk in two ways when I was in that position. The first is through the Children's Advocacy Center. And essentially how they get there is a child will disclose something that's happened to them to a trusted party, like a teacher, a babysitter, or something like that, another family member. And then those children are brought into the Children's Advocacy Center, which is a independent entity that provides a living room-like area for this child to come in and essentially tell the story about what happened to them. They're interviewed in a non-leaning manner. So the interviewers that interview these kids are either interviewers that are employed through the Children's Advocacy Center, or there's certain police officers that are trained to do so, and they have to go through intense training in order to be qualified to do that. But they essentially ask the child what happened to them in a non-leaning manner for us to get to the truth of what happened. And then from there, the child is provided different resources within the community, and the family is as well. And the Child Advocacy Center is grant funded, and then they also get resources from the Children's Protection Network, which is a non-for-profit in town. And then those kids will get access to resources that way, and they get therapy through the Children's Advocacy Center if necessary. And then the essentially police will run with that investigation and investigate it and do whatever it is that they need to do, follow up. Then the other way that those cases get to me is through, or get to our office, is through the police agencies are a part of a task force essentially that gets notified about people downloading child pornography in the area. And when they're notified of that, we execute search warrants. And then eventually on the perpetrator's residence, we obtain electronics. They do forensic downloading of those electronics, identify if any child pornography exists on those electronics, and then we prosecute them that way. So there's like two different ways essentially we get to the Crimes Against Children division in screening cases.
I would imagine that these crimes against children are difficult to deal with. And you mentioned that you were a psychology major before you went to law school. Is this hard for you? Was that hard for you?
I found it to be less difficult when I didn't have children of my own. But it became a little bit more difficult after I had my own kids. I just always reminded myself, though, that if something ever happened to one of my kids, I want somebody in that position that cares about what they're doing. It is a righteous endeavor. And so I really enjoyed doing it. Like, it mattered. Not that other crimes don't matter. They certainly do. But it was something that, you know, our office really cared about. And so I liked doing it. I enjoyed that job. And the person that's currently there is going to do an amazing job with it as well.
I had someone on my show, their name escapes me, a while back, who talked about child sex trafficking here in central Illinois. And they said it is prevalent. It happens, even right here in Bloomington Normal, in McLean County. How prevalent is it? If anyone really knows, it's you. Is it a thing that people should be talking about? Children getting in these terrible situations. Maybe it's child molestation. Maybe it's getting wrapped up with an older person, maybe it's even trafficking, selling their bodies. What do you think? Or even, I don't know about abduction and literally engaging in like online selling images. I don't know. You tell me. Is it a thing that we should talk about more? Is it prevalent?
Absolutely. I think with the access that children now have to technology, it's absolutely terrifying. It is not unusual for a child to engage in a conversation with an unknown person that they are presuming is also a teenager, and within an hour they're exchanging photographs that are inappropriate. I think kids forget that just because somebody tells you that they're a certain age certainly doesn't mean that they are actually that age. 9 out of 10 times they're not. They're lying to you. And these kids will exchange photographs and forget that the moment those photographs go out, you never get access again. Those photographs will end up wherever, whenever, and you have absolutely no control over that. That is scary prevalent. As a parent, it terrifies me. The social media, even through Instagram, which everybody uses, that happens where kids will start communicating with somebody they don't know and start sending photographs to them. And so it happens more than what people do and people think. And I think that with the access to technology increasing every day, it's going to become an even bigger problem.
Okay. Well, parents love to talk about this type of thing, give their own opinions, but you're in the trenches with this, and you have been. You have significant experience and significant knowledge on the subject. What will you do, assuming your kids are really young and that you don't have to really worry about it too much yet, how will you navigate this as a parent?
Oh, goodness. It's really difficult because peer pressure is a real thing, right? And so these kids are getting technology younger and younger. They're getting access to cell phones younger and younger. I will fight that tooth and nail. I will do whatever I can to avoid getting my kid any type of phone with internet access. And if there's any way to form a pack among a group of parents that my kids are going to school with, I will absolutely do that because the reality is these kids want it because other kids have it. So if all of the parents just absolutely refuse to do it, then they're not going to be as interested. And so I definitely will do whatever I can to avoid that as long as I can, understanding that that is not the definitive solution. And it certainly isn't a solution for everybody. And so when I finally do grant access, I will be on them 24/7 as far as having unfettered access. I certainly won't have allow my child to have a cell phone in their room at late hours of the night. That's typically when this is happening. Kids will go to bed. The parents think they're in bed and they're engaging in online activity with somebody and they'll be up all hours of the night. So I certainly will be monitoring that extensively.
And I've seen it. I'm almost laughing because I've seen parents like, oh, I'm keeping my kid's phone downstairs when they go to sleep. And I know the kids that will just wake up in the middle of the night, go downstairs, unplug their phone from the little charging dock that their parents have set up downstairs, take it up to their room and put it back there before their parents wake up. It's like so you're a psychology person. You major in psychology. Haven't you heard the saying that strict parents make sneaky kids?
We'll find out, I guess, right?
That's right. No, that's why I always say it's like, well, I plan on educating my kids on a number of things, like when it comes to how they value their body, what to look out for online, as well as this is why we're not going to let you have a phone. I'm on the same page as you. I just know that sometimes when parents like miss a certain step in educating their children on why they shouldn't even want to engage in this type of thing, why it's bad, what it looks like. Because some parents like don't want to tell their kids that there's weird, wicked people out there that want the worst for you, and they want to, I'm not going to go into details, but I don't know. I don't even know how we got on this subject, really, but it's really interesting.
Yeah, even in the high school, just local high schools, I can name off the top of my head multiple events where kids have engaged in consensual sexual activity, have photographed that, video that, because that is the norm right now. Kids are documenting every aspect of their life at that age, which is also terrifying, but they do it. And they've been raised that way through societal norms. And then they, you know, provide that documentation to a boyfriend or something, and then, you know, 3 weeks later they find out their boyfriend's cheating on them or their girlfriend's cheating on them, and that information is leaked on Snapchat accounts
out of
that
anger
exist.
They're like, well, yes, here is this girl's pictures because I'm mad at her because she cheated on me. Here, everybody.
Absolutely. Or, you know, I'm just over it. So I'm, and then they send this out to their friends to brag about it. You know, it's, if that kind of thing happened before there was documentation where guys and girls would talk about, you know, their exes inappropriately. But now they have documentation. And the problem is there are high school leaked accounts where they intentionally go on to these accounts and leak this information to embarrass their classmates. And the problem is when that gets out on Snapchat, it exists in the universe, so anybody can get access to it.
If you're a business owner who wants more business, you need a great website. It's where people first interact with your business. That's where BrandBuddy out of Pontiac, Illinois comes in. BrandBuddy makes your entire online experience a breeze, whether it's building a fully functional and visually stunning website with custom tools and buttons, or designing sophisticated advertising campaigns. BrandBuddy is the one-stop shop for your business. At BrandBuddy, an expert developer will listen to your needs and visions before building what you need. If you want to boost business and grow your online presence, call or text BrandBuddy today at 815-743-3074. I love pizza, especially pizza from Marshalloni's Pizza in Fairbury, Illinois. Experience Marshalloni's Pizza and their famous cheese nuggets for an amazing price when you order today. If you call them up at 815-692-4602 between 4 and 5 p.m. and order a pizza, you will get the second pizza of equal or lesser value for free. Restrictions apply. You can even pick up that order after the 4 to 5 window and still get that happy hour discount. As a pizza connoisseur myself, I will proudly say that my favorite barbecue chicken pizza comes from here, so check them out. 815-692-4602 and pick it up at 405 East Locust Street in Fairbury. They're open 7 days a week from 4 to 9 p.m.
Right. And man, I mean, for girls especially, I would imagine, like, that is a massive reputation ruiner and a psychological terror. I mean, that sounds almost like the type of thing that could lead a young girl to suicide. It's like just having her naked images leaked out for absolutely everybody to see. It's like, how much more humiliated could you be, and embarrassed and ashamed even?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's difficult stuff to talk about, but wow. Thank you for going down that rabbit hole with me there. Now to talk about a few things that people really want to know about that are affecting all of us. Not that that's not, of course, but you know what? I'm going to give you the mic a little bit. What do you think is the most urgent legislative update that the people of McLean County need to know about?
Well, I mean, obviously on the forefront of everybody's mind right now is the Safety Act and what exactly they're going to do with that. So to be determined in the future. But I mean, if you want to go into detail about that, we can talk about it.
I would absolutely love to, because I don't know how to separate fact from fiction with this. You hear a lot of things. All the criminals on January 1st were let out of these prisons. Crime is absolutely going to go up now because of that. Cash bail, it was a good thing, and now it's gone, and why is it gone? And so please tell us, what are some, debunk some myths, if you could, and maybe elaborate and explain some misconceptions.
Okay, so right now we're operating under the system that we operated in 2022 because of the stay that the Supreme Court put on after the Kankakee County judge determined that the Safety Act was unconstitutional. So across the state, everybody's operating under the 2022 rule.
So the Safety Act, technically speaking, has not gone into effect.
Correct.
Okay.
Or the pretrial portion of the Safety Act, because it was a voluminous bill, obviously, that covered a lot of different things. So the pretrial portion, which is the hot button issue that everybody's talking about. I think there are a common misconception about the way the system works as it exists. So several years ago, the legislators essentially put crime into two separate categories. You have a Category A and a Category B offense. Category B offenses, you get $30 a day of credit for every day that you're in custody after you're arrested and after you're charged, and that comes off of the 10% fee. So, for example, if you have a $3,000 10% bail bond that's applied to your case and you haven't been able to post, then the 10% is $300. So you automatically time out in the county jail within 10 days because you get $30 a day credit. And so after 10 days, we are mandated to release you.
And that's in effect now or not?
Yes.
That's in effect right
yes.
now.
Yes.
Okay.
So, and then there's Category A offenses, which is the more serious offenses. So a lot of your DUI is a Category A offenses, any Class 2, 1, Class X felonies, murder, a lot of sex cases. And so all of those are considered Category A offense. Domestic battery is also a Category A offense. So those, it doesn't apply to those cases. And the other thing about a Category B offense, when bond is being determined and it's a Category B offense, they automatically are entitled to a bond review hearing. So if bond is applied in a Category B offense, then there is a report that's done, like a subsequent follow-up report, and there's a bond review hearing that is done. So that is one thing that people don't realize exists as it currently as we currently operate. So we have Category A offenses, Category B offenses. The Category A's are the more serious offenses, and you're not entitled to that credit.
And you said Category X. Is
so,
it?
So the Class X felonies are in that.
Oh,
so
category
there's,
A.
You know, home invasion, things like that are in the Category A. Mm-hmm. And so you're not entitled to that credit. And so you're not going to time out on those. So you're going to be held until you can post the bond. In determining what the appropriate amount of bond is, there are several statutory factors that the court is mandated to consider in order to determine what people's bond should be. And that is an extensive list that currently exists in the statutes. And one of those is the defendant's employment. So if he is employed, and I use the term he generally, I don't mean specifically male or female, but just I.
Although the majority of inmates in the county certainly are male, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
So if that person is employed, that's a consideration that the court takes. The ties to the community, the likelihood of flight, that's based on whether or not they have prior failures to appear, his ties to his family, what his support system looks like. And all of those are factors that the court already considers in determining amount of bail. People think that prosecutors pick the bail, like we just get to pick a number and that's what's applied. The reality is we go to the court and we ask the court, please give us this bond on this particular case, and we argue why. And then the defense attorney argues why that's inappropriate and it should be less, and they ask for whatever they ask for, and then the court decides. Subsequent to that, the person can file a motion to reduce bond and then later on have another hearing on that bond reduction, arguing that it wasn't appropriate based on whatever factor they think is important. And then all of that can be appealed to the appellate court before the case is even resolved. And so it can be appealed while the case is still pending, the determination of bond and whether or not that was appropriate. So that is the system that currently exists. The Safety Act, obviously, they wanted to take that system away and put a no cash bail, you know, rule on certain types of offenses, and then everybody else is released. Mm-hmm. Prosecutors generally, and I don't want to speak obviously for everybody across the state, but in speaking to a lot of different prosecutors, they don't necessarily object to the idea of eliminating cash bail. In fact, it would make it more convenient for us because then we don't have to make a determination on what's appropriate a financial determination, what's appropriate for this particular type of case.
And argue about the numbers and waste a lot of time.
Yes. So we don't necessarily have a problem with the elimination of cash bail, but it certainly needs to be done in an appropriate way. And obviously we argued in front of the Kankakee County judge that it wasn't constitutional based on how it was implemented or how they wanted to implement it. And it was deemed unconstitutional. We're waiting for a ruling with the Supreme Court. So I can also walk you through some of the arguments that were made if you're interested.
I would love to, okay. Yes. This is going to be fuel to some people's fires.
Right. Okay. So we argued 8 separate things, and the court found in our favor on some of those and not on others. One of the things that we argued was that it violated the single subject rule. We argued that the criminal justice system generally wasn't specific enough. And so when you're requiring body cams, that implicates the police officers, but then you're also implicating the court system in this pretrial portion or the determination on where an inmate is deemed to be a resident of, whether or not you can count the county jails in that calculation for the census. So like some of those things were included in this, and so we argued that it violated the single subject rule. The Kankakee County judge sided with the governor, indicating that the criminal justice system as an entire umbrella was appropriate and that that was a single subject. And so we lost on that count. We also argued that it was unconstitutionally vague based on all of the different confusing dynamics that were going on. I mean, to give you an example, there were a couple pilot counties that were trying to implement some of this early to kind of as a trial run to show the other counties how to implement this.
Really?
And there were counties within the same circuit that were arguing about the way to implement this, and they couldn't agree.
So it's like, see, you see the chaos in these pilot counties already. That should go to show that this really is pretty vague and not obvious and not direct or something like that. It's hard to follow because of its vagueness, right?
Right.
That's what you're saying?
Yes. Okay. And the court denied us on that and grant in favor of the governor. And so we lost on that count. We argued that that it was a violation of the 3 readings requirement. So the thing about that is there is a doctrine. Well, under the law, you're required to read a bill on 3 separate days, 3 separate times. And the idea behind that is it gives the citizens of Illinois an opportunity to weigh in, to call the legislator, to say, no, this isn't a good idea. I don't want you to vote for this, and to kind of get public input is the idea behind the 3 readings requirement.
3 readings. Where does this go? Is this on TV or something? Is this for everyone to hear or what?
It is the legislators on the floor of the down at the Capitol. And so they're required to read this bill 3 times, 3 separate times on 3 separate days. As everybody's aware, this was introduced in the middle of the night and voted on at like 4 something in the morning. And they did not comply with the 3 readings requirement. Under the law, if you don't comply with the 3 readings requirement, then it is fatal and it kicks out the bill based on that.
Case closed then, right?
Right. Well, that was our argument. But the problem is the law does not give us, because of this legal doctrine, it doesn't give the trial court the authority to kick it out based on that alone. So we essentially asked the court, make the factual findings that the 3 reading requirement was not abided by and allow the Supreme Court to handle that in argument later on. So the court found in our favor that factually the 3 readings requirement was not complied with, even though the president of the Senate and the Speaker of the House signed under oath indicating that it was followed.
Who signed?
So as part of their process, the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate are required to sign under oath by affidavit that the 3 readings requirement was complied with. And they did that, even though we know, based on the minutes, that it absolutely wasn't complied with.
Can you call that a lie?
you can call it whatever you want.
I forgot who I'm talking to. You have to watch what you say. Sorry. You hear lies. They're lying. It's thrown out so much. It's insane. It's embarrassing. You turn on any news station. It's like, they're lying. They're lying. They're lying. It's like, how can these many people be lying and we're still working here? I don't know. But anyway, please continue.
So the three readings requirement, the court found in our favor that it was not complied with, even though that affidavit existed, because the minutes didn't reflect it. And so we're asking the Supreme Court to essentially overturn it on that basis. But we knew that the trial level, they could not overturn it on that basis. So we're just asking them to find factually in our favor, but to not grant any, to not deem it unconstitutional on that basis because he didn't have the power or authority to do that. So that went the way that we expected it to go, and it was found in our favor, but still denied as far as the constitutionality argument behind that, because it's something the Supreme Court can take up when it goes there. Then we also asked for a preliminary injunction asking that the court say that it shouldn't move forward and to basically stop it from being implemented until we figure out these arguments. And the court said it's not necessary for us to find on the preliminary injunction aspect because I'm ruling on it in its entirety. I'm deeming it unconstitutional. And if I deem it unconstitutional, every county that's a part of this lawsuit, McLean County was, because we had filed, it will not go into effect for those counties. And so it is a judgment on the merits, and the Supreme Court can take it up. So there's no reason to basically rule a preliminary injunction applies because it doesn't. So he ruled on the merits, and now it's going to the Supreme Court. So we were denied on that. Essentially it was a request to basically, if he couldn't make the decision, please give us the preliminary injunction until you can.
Which means, like, so we don't have to abide by all this?
Yes.
So if you can't make up your mind, just pass it, whatever, but at least for us, let's not imply this.
Yes.
Or not impose this or whatever.
Yes. And then as far as the arguments that we won on were the separation of power. So we argued that there was a separation of powers argument because for the judiciary specifically. Right now, if we go into court and we ask the judge to give somebody a personal recognizance bond, which is a basically sign a sheet and you're out, which happens on a lot of our cases. And so it's not uncommon for us to do that. But let's say we did do that. And the judge says, based on the factors of the case, I am not doing that and I am imposing a bond. Under the Safety Act, the prosecutors held all the power. So if we didn't file a petition, the judge couldn't do anything. So if we went into court and said, we are not filing a petition, we will not on this particular case, the judge had no power to detain the person. And so we argue that the judiciary's determination of setting bail is within their purview, and we shouldn't have the authority to take that power away from them as prosecutors. It should be on them and an independent, basically, arbitrator to figure out whether or not it's appropriate to detain this person.
Fairbury Furniture in Fairbury, Illinois has added over 7,000 square feet to their showroom, and that means more selection for you. Why wait for your furniture? You can buy anything on the showroom floor and take it home today. So hop in the car and take the short drive to Fairbury Furniture, where customers love their selection, pricing, and their take it home today power. So many Bloomington Normal residents have made Fairbury Furniture their favorite furniture store, just 26 minutes away in downtown Fairbury.
Hurry down to Fairbury Furniture, where the furniture rocks.
Choosing insurance can be complicated and daunting. That's why you need to call Pam Deaton with Health Markets. Pam will help you with all of your insurance needs, including health, life, vision, dental, and disability insurance. She's consistently been one of Health Markets' top national agents over the years and continues to earn great reviews from her clients. If you or a loved one needs to find the right insurance plan, you're in the right hands with Pam. Call her at 309-287-2518 to see how she can help you today.
If you've been living with an aching back, debilitating imbalances, or any physical discomfort and just want to get back to living a fit and happy life, look no further than In Motion Fitness Center and Outpatient Therapy at Fairview Haven in Fairbury, Illinois. Our highly skilled therapy team will guide you through proven and effective exercises to help you regain your strength, movement, and mobility, all with our renowned level of love and care. Live your best life. Call our therapy team at 815-692-6724 for to find out how we can serve you today.
And that is something that was misleading in the public. And knowing that we had this pending litigation, the prosecutors weren't talking about it. But the reality is, there, you know, the governor was out there saying to the public, if somebody is a risk to the community, the judges absolutely have the authority to detain them. And that is 100% false. The judge doesn't have any power unless we file that petition. And so it's kind of odd because we're essentially going in front of the courts and saying, courts, please don't give us the power that the Safety Act gives us, because you should have the final say in this.
Right. It's making more work for you. First of all, I just can't believe really that. So I know I'm putting you in a weird spot when I say this, so you can plead the fifth if you'd like.
Okay.
But for the governor to, and I would like to have Governor J.B. Pritzker on the show, but certainly he understands what goes into this bill, and he would know that it's not up to the judge to decide to detain, the judge alone anyway, to decide to detain any criminal. But he went ahead and said that anyway, despite that being your responsibility and it's not up to the judge. How do you do that? Are there no legal ramifications for that untruthful speaking, public speaking, I guess?
Yeah, the voter.
Ah, okay.
Is the response to that. The voter gets to decide if they're going to accept that from their politicians or not. I am going to presume that he understood how the Safety Act worked because he signed it. But certainly the judge doesn't have any power unless we give it to him. They have the power after we give it to them, after we file that petition, but the power doesn't exist prior to.
Uh-huh. Sometimes you hear people, you know, in my circles, they say like, oh, the governor, he lied and he knew what he was doing and he said this and he knew that that wasn't the case and they're just all liars and terrible. And granted, they're using a lot of adjectives and stuff. He's very terrible. He's horrible and stuff. But part of me always thought, yeah, you're crazy. Like this well-established political scene that we have in our state, it can't be that bad if it's running. And it's like, these are professionals, right? It's politics, but I guess you're kind of making me think twice about that. So very interesting. And I know you're not meaning to. Again, I apologize for.
No, that's okay.
But okay.
So that is one of the concerns that we had about the separation of powers. Like essentially the legislator was taking away the judiciary's authority. And we argue that there's a separation of powers that exists and they don't have the authority to do that. They also, you know, had mandated before the trailer bill existed that the judiciary not issue failures to appear warrants. And we argued before the trailer bill came out, because that kind of changed some of it, some of the dynamics, that the legislators can't do that. They can't mandate that we do this summons and rule to show cause hearings that they were going, which is like a huge other animal, instead of just issuing these failures to appear warrants. So which, again, the judiciary has exclusive control over and managing their docket. So that is the elementary version, I guess, of that issue. And then the other, so we were granted in our favor for that and against the governor. And then the other issue was, and these all kind of go together, but we filed on behalf of future defendants and future victims, essentially, the other two counts, and they kind of go together a little bit. So under Section 9 of Article 1 of the Constitution, the Illinois Constitution, it specifically indicates that a defendant has a right to a surety bond, and it specifically lays out that it has to be – I can't remember the specific language here, but I got it. So we argued under Article 9 that it says all persons shall be bailable by sufficient sureties. And then it excludes some of the offenses, like capital offense, which we don't have anymore in the state, offenses for which a sentence of life imprisonment may be imposed, felony offenses, and it specifies specifically. So this amendment has been changed a little bit over time, the Constitution essentially has been changed over time. So they have the capability of doing that if they wanted to. But as it exists right now, it says that any person shall be bailable by sufficient sureties unless one of the exceptions apply. And those exceptions have been expanded over time. So they have the capability of doing that if they wanted to put it to the voter, but it'd be up to the voter to decide. And so our argument was, because it specifically lays this out in Section 9 of Article 1 of the Illinois Constitution, the defendants have to have a right to bail. You can't put them in a situation where after they committed offense, they are detained indefinitely unless they exercise their right to a speedy trial. And so that was the one argument that essentially we made on behalf of defendants under our Illinois Constitution because of how strict our Constitution is worded. Mm-hmm. And then the flip side of that was on behalf of victims, which is Article 1, Section 8.1, which is the Crime Victims Bill of Rights. That exists and was passed in November of 2014. So it's relatively new, under the law. I mean, that seems like a long time ago, but it hasn't mm-hmm. really been that long. And under that section, crime victims have certain rights that we're mandated to comply with because they have constitutional rights that they can assert in a case. And one of those is under Section 9 of that, the right to have the safety of the victim and the victim's family considered in denying or fixing the amount of bail.
Mm.
Well, the issue is under the Safety Act, unless you your crime fell under a category in which it was detainable, the victim's safety was never a consideration. It just, you're only detained if you fall under one of these categories. And even if we file that petition, the court could still deny it.
So they just won't look at the finer details and the danger it poses that this person might pose to the family if they're let out. It's just, if you meet this criteria, it just seems more black and white, I guess.
It is much more black and white. So the safety of the family isn't considered or the mm-hmm. victim unless you fall under one of these categories. And then there's an additional criteria. But the victim's safety never really comes up. It's, the safety of the community or safety is to a specific person, depending on what subcategory within the detainable offenses you fall under. What was frustrating for us during this process is publicly the politicians were saying there's no such thing as a non-detainable offense. Well, the reality is there is, because unless you fall under this category, you're not going to be detained. Mm-hmm. And those categories were specified. They were laid out specifically on what crime was committed.
All right. Tell us a few of those, because this is what people get pretty fired up about. What are some non-detainable offenses?
Well, I guess that's the question for part for the Supreme Court, because the problem is during the election, the politicians were out there saying that if it is an offense in which the victim's safety is implicated, they can be detained. And specifically, domestic battery was something that you heard a lot about, was if it's a domestic battery, then that person, the judge absolutely has the authority to detain that person. The problem is, while making that argument publicly in this litigation, they're making a different argument. The argument that they made in the litigation was no misdemeanor can be detained ever. So somebody can commit a domestic battery on somebody and cause a bruise, and there could be a history of domestic violence in that family, but no criminal offenses. So we can't enhance that to a felony, and it's just a misdemeanor, and we can't do anything about that. We could, if the governor has his way in front of the Supreme Court, because in the litigation, the argument was no misdemeanor can be detained. And the reason they did that was because they knew that if you could be detained for a misdemeanor, you're running afoul of the Constitution. And so that's why they made those arguments. So we'll see what the Supreme Court does with it.
Huh. Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah. So one of the problems and the concerns that we had So like right now, if you get arrested on a domestic battery and you're told, okay, this is your first offense, so we are giving you a PR bond, we're personally recognizing you, and you can get out. All you have to do is sign a paper, but you cannot have contact with your victim. And there is, under the law, there's a mandatory 48 hours that's automatically applied, but the judges will typically give us a no contact order for the victim. So they're not allowed to have any contact. So let's say that individual goes back to the house under the current system. If the victim calls the police or somebody calls the police and the police end up being there, they can violate or they can arrest that person for violating that no contact order, because that is a different offense, and they can also arrest them for just violating it, right? Under the Safety Act position, only if the person had a active order of protection could the police arrest. So the problem that's presented is this. Somebody gets arrested on Friday night for a domestic battery. They're told on Saturday court that they're not allowed to have contact with the victim, and they're released. And he's upset. He goes back to the residence. He starts, you know, like refuses to leave, like basically squats in the house, or even at 3 o'clock in the morning stands across the street staring at her, right? And to in an effort to intimidate the victim, which is surprisingly not uncommon. The issue is the police can get called to the scene, they document it, and then they can send it to us for charges. But that person cannot be arrested under the Safety Act. And that is terrifying for us, because those, until that victim gets an order of protection, then they can't get arrested on it. And the other problem is, if an order of protection is also a misdemeanor, then we have this other issue that's presented, that if no misdemeanor can be arrested.
Yeah, that's so stupid. Yes. I mean, that sounds ridiculous.
Yeah, and unless somebody has a prior conviction for one of those offenses, they can't be enhanced to a felony. And so we get, you know, stalking cases that are like that. Things that, you know, where you've got somebody who just refuses to stop harassing their victim. And right now, it's easy to get that person back in custody if they continue that behavior. And it would be extremely difficult, sometimes impossible, under the Safety Act.
In the debates between Darren Bailey and J.B. Pritzker, J.B. did say that there are some changes that they would like to make to the Safety Act. That said, do you think that these mistakes in writing this bill were unintentional? Yeah, I'll just leave it at that. Do you think they were unintentional and it's like, oops, we didn't quite think about that, because guess what? We're people too.
I don't.
Meaning we're humans too. We make mistakes.
I don't know that. I can't say to what the intent is, but I know what the process looked like. And the process was, the prosecutors were essentially kind of cut out of the conversation initially. In 2021, I know that we had access to data indicating how many cases we recommend PR bonds on, where somebody just signs to show that we're not improperly arresting and housing a ton of inmates that shouldn't otherwise be there. And they were not interested in that data. I know that when it got passed, it was passed in the middle of the night. I think you do that with one intention, and that it wasn't passed with the three readings requirement. It was a voluminous bill that essentially overhauled the entire system, and it was passed in the dark of night with no input whatever from the relevant stakeholders. So, I mean, I can't speak to the intent, but they've had over a year. Almost two, basically, to fix some of the issues. They've elected not to. And so I don't know what the intent is. We have a serious concern within our county about victim safety.
Boy, this is unsettling. You know, you'd like to think that these systems of government so high up are legit, well-meaning, honest, and good. And I'm not saying you're saying otherwise, but it sure makes me think. It's really interesting.
Right. And we got a bad rap, the prosecutors did, for essentially filing this bill or filing this lawsuit, asking for it to be deemed unconstitutional. And the reality is, it gave us more power than we have had before. And, you know, the example that my first assistant, Brad Rigdon, who was essentially tasked over the last 6+ months with going through this thing and trying to figure out the odds and ends and training our office, helping with police officer training and things like that to get everybody kind of up to speed on what was supposed to be happening. And it just became very clear through that process that there weren't a lot of considerations that were made as it pertains to victim safety. And, you know, the example that he uses is if we had somebody that was identified in our county as a serial killer that was, you know, identified through forensics or whatever, and we had it documented that the person has murdered, you know, 10 people, if we don't file a petition, the court has no authority to detain that person, period. And so that person walks, and there's nothing that the court can do about it under the Safety Act. And we felt like that's problematic when you give the prosecutors that much power. One of the, on the flip side of the argument, one of the concerns that I have, because I came from the Crimes Against Children Division, right? And so that's near and dear to my heart. One of the concerns that I have is they expanded essentially the net of what it means to file the petition and be able to detain somebody and what we have to prove. But then they turn around and limited the definition of what we have to prove. So my concern, to give an example, it's the best way to illustrate it. The way that you detain somebody under the Safety Act is you have to prove that not the act, the criminal act itself, not the fact of a criminal charge to detain somebody, but instead the underlying facts of that criminal charge, and argue that that person is a risk to the community or a particular person. The concern that I have, for example, is child pornography, which is something that we deal with regularly in our office. Mm-hmm. And the issue is typically, there is a little bit of a stereotype. They live alone, or they live with like their mom, and they're downloading this pornography. We can't necessarily prove that they've ever actually touched a child, but that's presumably the next step, right? And one of the concerns that I have is that child pornography possession is a detainable offense, right? But the problem is, as prosecutors, we have to prove that not just the fact that the person is downloading child pornography, but the underlying facts of that case make it so that they are a risk to the community or a specific victim. So my concern as a former CAC prosecutor is, What are we going to say if the person lives in their basement or lives alone? What risk do they run of committing a crime against a child if they don't have direct access to a kid? I mean, they're not going to run any greater risk than anybody else would if they live alone or they live with their mom, right? Mm-hmm. Of committing a further crime, because we've taken all their electronics, so they're not going to be able to download any more pornography unless they go out and get more electronics to do so, which has ironically happened before. If they don't have access to a kid like across the street, what are we going to say to the judge that says, you know, not only did they download pornography, but they're also a risk to the community because, and I don't really know the answer to that. And that was one of the concerns that we had. So it's like, what do we say to the judge to say, you know, because my position has always been, judge, there's a child pornographer. Like, the next step is to molest a kid. And I can't tell you what kid that is because it's a crime of opportunity. Mm-hmm. So it may be the kid across the street. It may be the kid that comes over for a barbecue. It may be a kid that they, you know, touch in Walmart. I don't know. But the problem is, under the strict definition of community safety that was applied in the trailer bill of the Safety Act, made it difficult, or would make it difficult, for us to argue that a child pornographer in the basement of his mom's home downloading pornography is a risk to the community, and that no set of factors can mitigate that risk. because theoretically home arrest, if he stays at the house and get house arrest, that would mitigate it as long as there's no kids coming around. And mom will come in and say, well, I won't have any kids at the house. And I don't know what we say in response to that.
Right. Why was that trailer bill, that detail that you're talking about, why was that even – what was the good that could come out of that? Who could that protect from –
You'd have to ask the legislators that question. Like, okay. why they thought that was appropriate.
A good idea?
Yeah. Yeah.
Fascinating. Yes. Wow. Okay, well, for the sake of time, I do have a few other things I want to talk about, but Okay. Thank you for enlightening us on the Safety Act. And, man, there's a lot that goes into that. And we didn't even talk about some of the police stuff, you know, more about the body cams and everything. But I think we talked about some of the most important aspects of it for sure. Speaking of police, I'd like to ask about assault weapons. So this is big right now, and a new bill was recently signed into law that outlaws the sale and manufacturing of semi-automatic assault weapons, and also bans large magazines and rapid-fire attachments. Many county sheriffs are taking a stand against this, calling it unconstitutional and saying that they will not enforce it. Our own sheriff in McLean County didn't explicitly say that he won't enforce it, but he did say it's in total conflict with the Constitution. What do you think about all of this? What do you say about it?
So the state's attorney's office is not an investigative body, so we don't have any authority to go out and investigate crime. We essentially are a reactive agency, so we get cases sent to us based on what law enforcement is doing, and we screen those cases. You know, our office maintains discretion. We don't prejudge anything. We'll look at things as they come across our desk. Certainly this case is going to end up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, and we'll see what happens.
Okay. So you don't... Is that it?
Yes.
Okay. Wow. Okay, let me ask you this. What can the sheriffs do that? What happens? Because Governor J.B. Pritzker has said that there will be ramifications for those who go against their sworn oath to hold up the law in Illinois. He said there will be ramifications for them. Will there be? Could there be anyway?
You would have to ask Governor Pritzker what authority he would have to, I mean, certainly he is over the state police, right? He's got authority over them. Technically, he is their boss. But as far as what authority he has over local officials, you'd have to ask him where he's getting that information from.
Are you saying that he doesn't have much?
I don't know where he's getting that authority from or where he thinks he's getting that authority from. These are elected officials. They answer to the local residents.
Mm-hmm. Is he implying maybe that the higher up state police could come on down to McLean County and be like, either you say you're going to hold up this law or we're going to arrest you? Like, is that what he's implying would happen?
I have no idea what he's implying.
Okay.
I have no idea. I don't know what authority he thinks he has over local sheriffs, but the state police, I mean, the state police are already in this community. You had said something about bringing them down. They're already in this community. We have people, state troopers, that are all over regularly. I mean, we work side by side with them and we'll continue to do so. But local police agencies maintain their discretion, as does my office.
Okay. Well, that was sort of quick, quicker than I thought it'd be. Okay, let's talk about the fentanyl crisis in Illinois, though, because that is a really astonishing thing. I've talked to a guy that was running for sheriff of Livingston County, and he said that it's just crazy how it's just going up and up each year, the amount of overdoses and deaths from fentanyl in Illinois. It happens up in Chicago, right? You can walk down a lot of those streets and see the needles, right? Needles is how you do it? Fentanyl
one
or something?
Way, yeah.
Okay, well, you'll see those lying around, like these syringes and stuff. I know it's bad up there. Is it prevalent at all down here? And what does it look just across the state? You have the data. How's it looking?
It is a problem here. We have issues with methamphetamine, and we do have issues with fentanyl. You'd have to ask the coroner specifically what that data looks like as far as how many deaths there are. But it's extremely dangerous. I mean, we have had people, even somebody recently in the courthouse that had to be Narcan because they were experiencing an overdose. Narcan is an antidote, essentially, that police officers carry with them. And if somebody isn't experiencing an overdose from fentanyl, they can shoot them with this Narcan or give them like basically kind of like a shot is what it looks like. And it's kind of crazy to watch because the person will almost instantly wake up. You know, it may take a minute, a second, a couple seconds for them to come to, but then they will immediately kind of wake up.
It's like they came back to life is what I've heard.
It does look like that. And I think that it's a serious problem. Like just a couple days ago, I saw in the news that the Graham Correctional Facility had to use like over 100 doses, I think, of Narcan because there was a fight that broke out within the facility and somehow some fentanyl had been smuggled in some way and it became airborne. People don't realize how dangerous it is because if it's airborne, everybody in the vicinity can drop dead from it. And if you touch it, I mean, one of the things that our officers are really combating right now is when you pull somebody over and you find substance on them and it's a white, you know, gray, powdery substance, there's questions about whether or not it contains fentanyl. And if they open up that bag and it becomes airborne or they touch it simply just with their hand and no gloves on, it can wipe the person out. I mean, we've had police officers that have had to be Narcaned.
You're kidding me. Really? And, just from touching some of this? It's that potent?
Yeah. And so one of the things that I had done it had started under my predecessor, but in meeting with Senator Sally Turner in order to propose legislation that would enhance fentanyl penalties. So if anybody delivers fentanyl, it enhances the penalties to not less than 9 years and not more than 40 years and $250,000 fine or both could be imposed. And then for the class X and then the class one, there was a class one felony that could be imposed if you knowingly use an electronic communication device in order to deal fentanyl, in order to hold some of these dealers accountable. So I spent some time in drug court, which is a rehabilitation program essentially that we have within McLean County. And it's so in lieu of going to prison, they go into a drug court program and we monitor probationers, defendants who have pled guilty to crimes on drug court and basically give them intense resources in order for them to kick their addiction. With the parameters being that you have to have committed your crime in connection with and some type of addiction. And, you know, one of the things that they really preach in that is people, places, and things, staying away from people who are dealing to you, staying away from things that will increase your likelihood of use and the places in which you've been using. And so the thought process with Senator Sally Turner was, why don't we enhance the penalties for dealers who are essentially leeches on our community and are going out and preying upon some of the most vulnerable citizens and utilizing their addiction for financial gain and remove them from society.
Yes. I mean, they are the epicenters of all of it, right?
Yes.
They're the cancer. They're where the cancer starts and they spread out to these other unexpected, vulnerable, a lot of times young too, like young men are really getting into this a lot, fentanyl. Yeah, it would make sense to enhance those punishments for them. So are there dealers in like Bloomington Normal, you would imagine?
Yes.
Like
there's
a number of them, like multiple?
We have an entire drug unit within our office that works with a task force that's set up with all the local police agencies that kind of combine resources and go after dealers within the community. We have currently two prosecutors and a support staff member that all they do is handle drug cases.
Okay. If you had to guess between what number and what number in like McLean County, how many dealers do you think there are? That's a crazy question because they're probably doing a pretty good job of hiding. Maybe how many users?
Well, most dealers use because that's kind of how they get into it sometimes. But I couldn't guess. I mean, hundreds.
In McLean County?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's there's a lot. It keeps them busy.
You're saying hundreds of dealers?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. I mean, there's a lot. And the problem is, define dealers, right? You have your supplier who's giving to the dealer, who's giving to the user. You know, you could have five layers there of people that are transferring that drug to finally get to the actual user. And so but it is a fully operating enterprise in McLean County.
Wow. Do you have hope that we can tackle this?
Well, I certainly don't think we should lose hope in tackling it. I mean, the leaps and bounds that drug court has made with some of these people who are users, and certainly when you remove some of these bigger dealers out of the community, it eliminates the source. I think that the education that's come with the opioid crisis and the number of people that are losing their lives every day and the risk. But the problem is the cartels are also getting increasingly creative with how they market this, right? So like now they're creating it in candy form in order to attract younger users. And so, it'll look like, a Pez or a little like Tic Tac, and they create it in that form in order to try to gen up more customers at a younger age.
And how do they get those customers? Do they give it to some unsuspecting person and get them hooked? Is that how that works, or is it another way?
I have heard of people that have their first as an 8, 9, 10-year-old kid because their parents use. I've heard of people who will initially get addicted to painkillers because of a legitimate injury, and then the doctor cuts them off, and they have no resources in order to deal with that, or they don't think they have any resources to deal with that, and they start using on the street. And so, I mean, it's the terrifying thing is, what I have heard is that the initial high is the high that everybody's chasing, because that initial high is the best high. Mm-hmm. And so it takes more and more to get to that point. And, the most terrifying aspect of this is you could use regularly and be fine, go into jail because you get caught doing something that you're not supposed to be doing, sit out, basically detox, go into treatment, come out of treatment, think that you're good, and then get reintroduced to it, do the same amount you were doing when you were arrested or when you went into residential treatment, and die from it. Because it's not an exact science. These people are manipulating the dosage levels in order to increase the productivity from it. And so it just kind of depends on that particular person on that particular day, what their body can handle. And it's terrifying.
Right. Right. And if you detox, I mean, it's like I used to drink 7 cups of coffee a day, full caffeinated. And I've tapered off to virtually like 1 cup of coffee a day, and then it's 90% decaf. If I drink 7 cups of coffee today, I would probably go into a panic attack.
Right.
It would not be good. So right. I can't imagine fentanyl, having that much time off. And Where does fentanyl come from? You hear a lot of people say that 90% of this stuff comes from across the southern border. Where does it come from?
I think that's a safe assumption. There's a lot of production in China. And so who knows? I mean, we can only cooperate so much, and that's certainly more of a question for the FBI.
Sure. And you can decline this question, but do you think a wall actually would help with that? That's what you hear a lot. I've heard it a lot, from my conservative friends. Like, well, of course, it's all coming from over the southern border. That alone is enough reason to build a wall. Would a wall do anything?
I think that's up to the voters to decide.
There we go. Okay. Well, man, we've certainly talked about a lot of great stuff, from assault weapons to, very briefly with assault weapons, as well as the Safety Act and the fentanyl crisis here. Just to wind down this whole thing, why did you come into this office in the first place? I know that you're filling in for the man who's now a judge, Judge Knapp. Why did you decide to go in this profession, though?
The overall profession? So that story started Goodness, I wouldn't have been 10 years old. I was watching Law & Order. I loved SVU, which may have not been appropriate for that age, but I loved watching it. And I essentially asked my mom how you do that. And she's like, you got to go to law school. You got to become an attorney. I'm in the middle of three girls. My older sister and my younger sister are both police officers. So it's just kind of in our blood. And so, I mean, it was, I can't really explain necessarily where it came from, but both of them are, my younger sister's a homicide detective and does a lot of violent crimes. And then my older sister's in internal investigations. And so that was always what it was going to be.
Like, this sounds like a no nonsense group of sisters. Oh, my God.
You could say that.
Hopefully, no one saw that on camera. Sorry.
So I knew I was going to go to law school. So I did. And then when I got my first job, so I was coming out of law school in 2012. The economy wasn't what it is right now. And you had to compete for jobs. And so I just kind of started applying everywhere and randomly ended up in Woodford County to prosecute there under the state's attorney, the current state's attorney, Greg Meir. And so I prosecuted there from 2012 to 2015. I really liked it. It was a great group of people. I loved the judges I was in front of. And I got the fundamentals that I wanted in order to expand my horizons. And then I got a call from now judge, then state's attorney, Jason Chambers. And he said, how would you like to come work in McLean County? I was interested in this county because of the size and access to some of the crimes that are handled by the office. I knew that in Woodford County, I'd be limited on what I could handle because the state's attorney carries his own caseload over there and handles some of the major cases. I really had my eye on the crimes against children caseload, and I knew that that wasn't something I was necessarily going to get access to over there. And so the advantages of joining a bigger office appealed to me. So in 2015, I came here and was put in the drug unit for a couple years, transferred into general felonies for a couple months, and then became the Crimes Against Children prosecutor 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so as part of my position and my promotion, I was placed on the leadership team that Don Knapp had created within the office. And so as part of that, we were kind of like an advisory board to him on policy decisions within the office, personnel moves and things like that. So that's kind of where I started dipping my foot into this whole arena and more of the management side of things. And so then when he announced that he was going to run for judge, it was something that I was interested in. And then, you know, I think it's important for our office to have some stability. And certainly the stability is better when promoted from within as opposed to bringing an outsider in, and because who knows what they're going to do. So the known quantity of me being within the office, I think, was a positive. And I was certainly aware of the infrastructure and some of the personnel decisions that had been made, the positive negatives of each employee. And so then when it was announced that he was going to be appointed early to the bench based on his election win, I decided to throw my name in the hat.
How do you like it? How's that for a question?
Been an honor. I mean, it's been great. I mean, there's things obviously that I wasn't aware of that you learn, you know, as you get into a new position. But, you know, I feel honored.
Are less and less people becoming attorneys?
Yes, it's been a really big problem. So my understanding is law school admission is down. Law school graduation is down. Bar passage rates are down. Apparently, a couple years ago, they increased the difficulty level of the multi-jurisdictional portion of the exam. And for whatever reason, Illinois did not account for that and lower their passage rate requirement. They left it staying the same. The states around us lowered their rates in order to accommodate that. So there's people that have not passed the bar exam in Illinois that are currently practicing in Missouri or Indiana or whatever, wherever around here. So that's been problematic for us. There's less people going and there's less people that are passing the bar and just less people that are interested in it.
And as you explained to me before we began, lawyers are just anyone who graduates from law school, but in order to become an attorney, a practicing attorney, you have to pass the bar exam, correct?
Yes.
So do we need more attorneys?
Yes. And we need more people that are interested in criminal law. You know, one of the frustrating things for somebody who's graduating law school is that you have hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt that you're coming out of law school with, because you have your undergrad debt, you have your law school debt. And becoming a prosecutor really has to be a calling, because you're not going to make a ton of money compared to somebody that's in private practice. You know, there's people that are in private practice that make double, triple sometimes what the prosecutors do in our office that are trying the exact same cases. So that is frustrating, but there are options out there. There is a debt relief program that if you go to law school and you work for a non-for-profit or government entity within the state 10 years, then you can apply for student loan forgiveness. And so people do take advantage of that and then kind of venture out after. But it is an incentive to get people to do these jobs, because we don't make as much money as people think we do.
Yeah, no kidding. Geez, so a name that everyone knows is funny. Jay Jensen, right? Attorney at law.
Yes.
That's a private practice. Anyone that has their own building with their name on the thing, that's a private practice, whereas you are an attorney for the state or the county. Right?
Like, yes, that's... we the prosecutors in my office and the civil attorneys all are paid by the county. And so it's the county taxpayer that's essentially paying that bill.
Could you break off if you wanted and start your own private practice?
Yeah, people do all the time. And, you know, the incentive to get into being a prosecutor is either for that debt relief or because it's a calling, which most of the people in my office, it's a calling to them. They enjoy what they do, and they understand that sometimes it's going to be long hours. People don't realize how often prosecutors in the office, the attorneys in my office work Saturday. We have Saturday court. We work over the weekend, and they're salaried. And they, you know, there's times, to give you an example, when I went on my first maternity leave, we had charged somebody with murder. That went to trial as soon as I got back from maternity leave. So I immediately went into murder prep. Preparation, and I was prepping a murder case for 2 months, and we worked every Saturday, sometimes on Sunday. And, you know, there were some times for a couple weeks I saw my 5-month-old because my husband would bring her to work and let me see her to eat lunch with or dinner with, or at night when she needed to feed. Like, those were the only times I was seeing her, because it is such a time commitment when you're doing these bigger cases. And I don't think people realize that. It's not unusual for a prosecutor to work a 12-hour day. There's certainly people that don't have to do that, and that is not the norm. It's not like they're working that every day. But they really put in a lot of effort to keep this community safe, and they make a lot of sacrifices. You know, when a murder happens, people don't realize this, but when a murder happens in McLean County, it's all hands on deck. We send at least one prosecutor, if not two prosecutors, to the police agencies to sit there with them to help coordinate getting search warrants for things if needed. And the police agencies, it's all hands on deck. I mean, they literally for 2 days, that's all they do. And I mean, it's not uncommon for them to go 48 hours without sleeping, or they'll sleep 3 hours and be back at it. And some of them live at the police agency for a week. I mean, people don't realize that. And that to them, it doesn't matter who the victim is. They want to solve this case. And so they make a lot of sacrifices. I've watch police officers skip, you know, personal family events in order to do their job.
Incredible. All for the sake of law, order, and justice.
Yeah,
it's absolutely a noble profession. Couldn't they just pay you a little more, though? My goodness, you're doing noble work.
The prosecutors would like that.
Yeah. Well, Erica, it's been a great conversation. I have learned so much. I really appreciate your time today. Before we go ahead and sign off, is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, I just really appreciated this opportunity. It's nice to be able to talk to people that are interested in this type of thing, and to be able to sit down and kind of get in the weeds to explain positions, because sometimes it doesn't fit in like a 5-second soundbite. So it's nice to be able to talk directly to people so that they can understand the issues. And it's just been an absolute honor to be the state's attorney over the last several months.
Yeah, well, it's been an honor speaking to you today and listening to you and having you explain everything so eloquently. It's been wonderful. A lot of this stuff we've covered today has been shrouded in mystery for a lot of people, so I really appreciate your time, and thank you, everyone, for watching and listening to this episode of The Paul Garcia Show. That was Erica Reynolds. Until next episode, God bless and have a great week.